Yeah, I've seen a few of your episodes. Yeah, I knew who you were before you reached out, so.
Mark, our reputation precedes us.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time. Mark, I'm ready to start if you're ready to start.
Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
Talking Joe is on the air.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the comics podcast for G.I. Joe. Today we are speaking to special guest Kikli, well, Yilkik. I'll double check the pronunciation of the surname there, but Kikli may be famous to many of you already. He's based in Minnesota and has been publishing and making art professionally for over 20 years, and most famously for this community here, lots of G.I. Joe art. He's had published work that includes Western, Purdy, action, science fiction, children's books, and being published globally. He is also got an interesting side career all about being an official pro sports artist. So we'll talk to that subject a little as well. But I will not be doing it alone, because I am joined, as always, by my co-host, who hides underneath his desk when we're not speaking. It is Tim Finn.
Hides, lives. Hello, Mark. Hello, listeners. Hello, viewers. Let's get to our guest.
Here he is. Can you kick it? Can you kickily it? Yes, you can. It's Kikkily. Here we go.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome to Talking Joe.
Thanks for
having
me. So
good to have you on.
Yeah, nice to see you, Mark. Nice to see you, Tim.
First up, do you want to correct me on my pronunciation?
Yeah, to clear that up, that all came about. So it's just Kikkily. When I joined Facebook, they wouldn't let me have one name. So they said, you know, I had to have a last name. So I just I just flipped it around. And I thought at that time, which was kind of funny, I was like, what I thought of first was Tomax and Zaymot, you know, I was like, I'll Tomax and Zaymot it, you know, I'll flip it around. And so that to me, I just like, I didn't ever think about it. And then everyone who I meet is always trying to yickle, and I'm like, I don't know how to say it either. I'm just, you know, I never think about it, but yeah, it's just Kikkily. It should be my real last name. I was in a car accident about 10 years ago now. And, I had, after going through rehab and everything, and, long story short, once I started making art again, I went to go sign my name, and I was like, I'm going to take back my real family last name. So I just put it, and I was like, I'll work underneath this if I show this work to anybody. And so I just started signing Kikkily. And so then a publisher, I was in Paris for 4 or 5 years, France, and I was going out to eat with publishers, and I kind of got wooed back into making comic books, because I was painting and I was like, I'm going to be a painter, but I didn't really know how to go about it, because it's a completely different world. It's similar, but it's different because of the whole system of having galleries and shows and displaying your paintings and having agents and dealing with the, you know, the museums and stuff like that. But so I was like, I'll just do one. I had a couple good ideas, and I just went with that. And then I started making comics, but I was like, I told the publishers, I'm like, I'm working underneath this name now. So my original goal was just to work underneath that name. And I told them, I was like, I don't really want anyone knowing who I am. I don't care about any of that stuff anymore. I just want to do the work and let it stand on its own. So probably for like three or four years, people didn't know who I was. So there's, especially in France or in the French speaking world of comic books, they were all wondering who I was. So, and then I had to start doing signings and everything. And that's where it slowly started coming out, because a lot of the French artists over there already knew who I was, and they're like, wait, what? What is going on? You know? So, yeah, that's kind of how it came about.
Is there an evil twin somewhere nearby? And when you see art that causes you distress, this evil twin also feels bad?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I have to decipher evil twin. So like my old self of like the name, like, you know, that I worked under before was, you know, name I still go by in private life, I guess, in my civilian life, Sam Heady. So, yeah, it's like people found that out. It just, you know, at the time it was, you know, I wasn't trying to, you know, it caused a stir, I guess, when, you know, when I did that and I left my old life. And, you know, I kind of, you know, it's not until I have to do these kind of interviews that I have to kind of go through and think about what it was. But it just, at the time I was injured and, you know, dealing with post-traumatic stress and everything. And I didn't realize that it was post-traumatic stress until I went through physical rehab and everything, and they were wanting me to do like more of a mental side of it, like a group therapy type stuff. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, well, what else are you going to do? Because I'd go to therapy and then come home and go to bed and lay down in my bed, and kind of, I was depressed and in a bad place. And so I was going, the first class of that was just like, hey, if you're going through these steps, these five or six steps, this is post-traumatic stress. And I was like, wait, what? I was like, I only thought soldiers, you know, got that, you know, from war. But they're like, no, it's everyone gets it from trauma and everything. So, it, you know, it just something that the therapist said in there was, you know, at some point, because, you know, everybody, because I went through like a physical transformation and everything. It's like I lost a ton of weight. I looked like a skeleton. You know, my skin was gray. You know, it was just, I looked horrible. And people kept asking, like, if I went out to anywhere, what happened? And I'm like, oh, I don't want to keep telling people this. You know, I was still injured and everything. And so the group therapist was like, you know, you just have to, like, leave this old part behind, because I couldn't make art. Every single time I was coming around my art, or when I went into my studio and stuff, I felt like passing out or blacking out. And they're like, yeah, it's part of the post-traumatic stress. So you have to do something in order to jumpstart your system again. And, you know, this was like almost a year. And, you know, everything that I've built myself to be, and the business that I created, and, you know, I had movie options, I had, you know, major book deal, all, you know, self-publishing, everything was built on this. And it was like, for a year, I couldn't do it. And it just was like, I didn't think I'd ever be able to do it again, because where I was injured in my back from the car accident, I was injured in two spots. One, the top part went down my right arm, which was my drawing arm. And if I put any kind of pressure on my leaning, if you lean your arm down and draw with your wrist, which I did, it would just cause a lot of pain and I couldn't draw. So I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So after rehab, they said, you need to do something different. And so I went to Paris. My wife's aunt is French. So I went to go stay with her and her daughter who lived over there. And I went back and forth multiple times, you know, and then I started getting work and everything. So I was going there for work then. But it took a few trips. Like the first trip that I went, I think I started trying to draw towards the end of the trip, which I was there for a few months. And when I came home, that I think I start, you know, I was, I can't remember, like, again, it's kind of like a weird blur, because when I say it's been 10 years, it's like, it feels kind of like yesterday, but a lot of it is, you know, very, time is mashed together in a weird way. So, It's not until I see the books that I've done since that I can kind of remember the time and where I was, because, you know, comics take a long time to work on, and you know, and just having those successful accomplishments of getting the book done, I remember those times in a sense. So otherwise it's a big blur.
Yeah, Tim thinks of time in blocks of about 24 years between starting a book.
Yeah. No, and I was, you know, the first two books, so I did a book called Musnay, which was The Mouse of Monet. It was about a little mouse that stumbled upon Monet's garden in France. He was like a little vagabond mouse. Because I was studying all these painters, and again, I was painting, but I was in the museums all the time and doing studies of paintings and trying to figure out how these people work. Because since I was injured, when I went to Paris for the first time, I was just like, okay, I felt like the way that I went about my art career prior, it was always in the back of my head of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I would see all these French impressionist painters or, you know, classic painters that we all know. And I would just kind of feel like, oh man, I don't know anything. These guys, you can tell, like, they know anatomy very well. They know how to sculpt. They know how to paint. And once you kind of get going, or once I kind of started getting going and getting known before, it kind of felt weird to stop. You know, I you know, it's just like I have jobs coming in. I have books that I need to finish. So there's really no time to stop and be like, I'm going to learn how to do this properly. So when I was in, after I went to Paris from the accident, I was like, I'm not going to try and relearn how to draw or do things the way that I did before. This is my chance to really wipe the slate clean and just treat. I literally was like, okay, I don't know anything. This is how I'm going to approach everything, is I don't know anything, and I'm going to really try and learn how to do this. I don't know if it's the right way, but kind of the way I thought before is just like, I'm going to learn how to classically make art by studying these masters. And I really started seeing right away, like, because you go into museums and you'd have Rembrandt, you know, Rembrandt would kind of be in his own section of the impressionists and stuff like that. But once you kind of got into more of the impressionist section, you know, you'd have Degas next to Renoir, next to Manet, next to Monet, you know. And I was all confused, because I'm like, I know who these guys are, but they all have similar names and they all have similar styles in a weird way. But I was like, because of how they kind of jumbled all these paintings around, wasn't like Monet had a section and then Renoir had a section, and still they just kind of intermingle them. And I started seeing right away, like, these guys all know the same thing. And it's like, this has to have been taught. So I started kind of really going down the rabbit hole of reading what I could. And certain museums would have sketchbooks out every once in a while under glass. And I would get so frustrated, because I'm like, can you just turn the page? Like, there has to be like a button here that would turn the page that you don't turn the book. But, you know, collecting books there with sketches, you know, artist sketches and, you know, notes and everything, I started kind of piecing it together. But the first time that I came home, you know, I was here for a few months, then I went back. And, you know, I was painting when I got back home then. And then when I went back the next time, that's when I really started painting. Yeah, it's just, you know, that seeing little things of how they all worked. And I was kind of trying to decode their knowledge. Rembrandt, going to Rembrandt then and finding out about him, it's like they, if you became like a study of his, or like a, you're kind of almost like a studio slave in a weird way, of like you'd start you off with the broom and you'd broom for 3 or 4 years and you wouldn't touch anything. And then you'd, if you stuck around, right? If you stuck around, then he'd have you building his canvases or priming his canvases, or then mixing his paints, because, you know, they didn't come in tubes. You'd have to get oil, pour it with the pigment and mix it together. And every morning he would get there, some kid, I'd imagine, would be there a couple hours earlier mixing his paints. So by the time Rembrandt would come to the studio, his paints would be ready and fresh, you know. But it's kind of like Karate Kid, the wax on, wax off, and all that stuff is like, when are you going to teach me karate? It's like weirdly enough, he's probably teaching you how to paint. And and if you're in that studio that long watching him work, you're going to be in, you know, brooming and watching, right? And I think you'd probably pick up a lot of information just before you even start painting. So all this knowledge kind of fed into the Musnad book then. And when I was, like I said, I was going out with a few publishers, I mean, the big publishers in Paris. And I pitched them a few ideas and it got shot down. They're like, nah. I pitched them a really cool sci-fi comic, which I wrote. You know, I wrote a full script on and sent it in, and the editor liked it, but the publisher said no, or the main company. And so they're like, maybe try like a kids series. And so I pitched them this mouse thing, because my wife's aunt, she was off of work, and she was like, we should go, because I'd come home from the museums and just be like, Monet is my favorite. You know, I don't know what it is about his work, but it's really cool. And she's like, well, you know, he's got his house and garden not too far. It's like a half hour drive, 40 minute drive to his house. So we went and I was blown away. I didn't want to go. I was like, a garden? You know, I've seen enough gardens. But then I was like, what am I thinking? No, I want to go.
You're going to see the light that he saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see exactly. The water that he saw on the leaves.
Yeah. But when you're in Paris, I don't know. It just, I kind of adopted the mentality of the George Costanza mentality, where I was like, I'm going to do the opposite of everything I ever thought before. Cause I've been, you know, wrong about certain things. And like I said, I'm rebuilding my life in a way. I'm just going to rebuild my whole mind. And so I'm like, I'm going to do the opposite of everything I've ever thought and did before. And so I was like, no, I'm going to go to this garden. And it was amazing. It's just, I spent so much time just in the garden portion. And they, you know, then you can walk through his house and everything. He has a museum, and not connected to the house property. It's kind of more in the back, inside this village. But he has his Monet's collection of the paintings that he has from friends, and, you know, things he probably traded paintings for, or, you know, other artists gave him. So we went to that. But before we went to that, we got something to eat, and a little mouse got trapped, was in the area where we're eating outside, and people were eking and kind of like, ah, it's a mouse, you know. And so I was just teasing my wife's aunt of like, don't worry, because I could see she was kind of like, a mouse and we're going to eat, you know, kind of deal. So I was like, oh, don't worry, it's just Monet's mouse, and he lives in his beard and he learns how to paint, you know. And she was laughing the whole time, and I was thinking, this is kind of a good idea. So I kind of stashed away in the back of my head. And so when they asked me for like a children's idea, I just started kind of, well, this mouse that stumbles upon Monet's garden, and they're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I just kept saying it, and they're like, do you have any drawings? I'm like, yeah, no, I'll send you something tomorrow. And I was up all night, trying to draw this stuff, you know, because I was still injured. So I started using my left hand a lot. And I did the first book and the part of the second with mainly my left hand.
For our listeners, our viewers, there are four books.
Yeah, there's four. Yeah. And it's the first book is spring, then the second book is summer, then it's fall and winter. So it's the season of the garden. Because hanging around there then, because the first time I went, I didn't take any photos, nothing. I just went to just go and look. And then I was like, shoot, I should have took pictures. So I went back there, but it was winter at that time, and I had to take photos over the fence because the garden was closed. It's closed during the winter. Just the gardeners work there. They strip the whole thing dry. There's nothing left over. They just take up every plant. It's pretty cool how it looks. So I was taking photos in the winter that I had to use for spring for this book. And then after the first book came out, I was like, I want this book in their bookshop, which it's the bookshop is like his third studio. So he has three studios. The first one he never worked in. It was just more for when he'd have famous guests like opera singers or, you know, whoever would come over and want to buy a painting, he would have like this fake studio in a sense set up, with his paintings hanging on the wall and like an easel or something to make it look like he worked in there. But the first time I went in there, I was like, he didn't work in here. And my step aunt was like, how do you know that? And I was like, I can just tell, like the light is the same as my studio. There's no north light. And all these artists, everything that I've read is they all worked under north light because it's more consistent. It's like a reflected light that's a consistent ambient light all day. And where my studio that I'm in right now is, you know, east, south, and west light, and the sun travels, so it's different light all day long. I can draw on this light, but painting is not like, to do a painting, you only have, you know, the sun changes so much that you have a different, the painting will look completely different all day long. The colors will. So north light is what they painted under. So after the first book came out, I reached out to the Monet Foundation and asked if I could come take proper pictures of the home. And they were like, yeah, they already knew who I was. And they invited me and they took me out to eat, you know, like a three-star, the chef, they introduced, you know, the chef came out and introduced himself to me. And I was just like treated very well. And I was like, this is really cool. And I kind of started adopting the idea of like, okay, I'm on sacred ground here. Like, don't do anything stupid, you know, like treat this like really sacredly, I guess, you know, like walking on eggshells, any kind of terminology like that. It was just like, just, you know, don't, be as respectful as possible. It just for the lineage of not going in there and being like trying to sell or, you know, it's just, again, I've read so much about these guys and I knew so much about Monet that, you know, because at first pre-accident, I thought like probably how a lot of people think is Monet, oh, happy guy painting these beautiful colors, the flowers, all this. And no, he was a wreck. His mom died when he was really young. Then the love of his life, his wife, his first wife. I think he got married again. I don't think he did though. I can't remember now. But his first wife died and he was just depressed. He was laying in bed. If it rained, they said, like all the people that I talked to there, because the gardeners were like a lineage of family gardeners. So I learned really quick, ask the gardeners because they would know the best stories because the generation before them told them about them, you know, about Monet. So they told me the best stories. And they would say, like, whenever it would rain, Monet would be in his bed and wouldn't want to get up, and he would throw tantrums, and, you know, they kind of had to get him out of bed to eat and move around and stuff. So I thought that was pretty fun because he wanted to be outside painting. So the rain was spoiling his day. And then they said also, like, he considered himself a gardener first and a painter second. And that really blew me, like what Tim's head was like, huh? Like, is, yeah, I was like, wait, what? No, he's a painter. I was like, no. And then after spending like a lot of time in the gardens, I understood what it meant. Is he didn't paint for 3 years when he started making, or when he bought that property and he started planting these plants, because he was figuring out how to be a gardener and make these flowers, these different combinations of flowers grow, so that there was color theory within his garden. And I was just like, it gets really deep, because the gardeners there still have like a, I don't know, 15 to 20 year plan before his blueprints are fulfilled. So they're still trying to make it the way he wanted it, because he left detailed instructions before he died. So spending enough time there, I saw, like, he saw the life and death cycle of these plants three times before he started painting them. And so he really understood this place before he started painting. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna kind of, how do I put this in the story? And that's kind of where I came up with the four books of the seasons of the garden. You know, there's life and death. And at that time too, my dad was dying. So it kind of had this weird backstory. So by the time you get warning, by the time you get to the fourth book, it's kind of sad since it's a winter season. But there's beauty in that too. It's like, because there's something seeing the garden going from this full spring, summer, fall. Each season he had different flowers would come up and bloom, and you'd get different color theories. And then winter, everything's gutted. It's all dirt and, you know, a little bit of snow. There's not too much snow there, but it's cold, rainy mainly. And so you have that season, and it's cool. I haven't thought about it for a while because I haven't, you know, I worked on that first series and got it done and moved on to the next one. So
Tim, as a retailer, you stock this book, don't you? How did you discover it? You know, it's French published. It's not necessarily the US regular mainstream comics.
Good question. So there's a small publisher in the States, Uncivilized Books, and I'm on an emailing list from an independent sales agent in New York who represents a lot of small publishers to comic book stores that either aren't carried through Diamond or are, but in small quantities. And when those books sell out, Diamond doesn't rush to restock them. And I get three emails a day from this independent sales agent in New York. And a lot of it is like catalog announcements and press releases and pictures of covers and descriptions and price and page number and dates. And I'm sort of always looking for something that's a good fit for my store. And there's a small strata of independent publisher in America, or that's sold in America, like Avery Hill, they're British, Uncivilized Books. If any of you are Craig Thompson fans from Blankets or Habibi, Uncivilized Books has been publishing his most recent work, which is called Ginseng Roots. And like Highwater Books, which is long out of business. But these are publishers that either make it's like they're not doing like big genre stuff that becomes movies, like superhero stuff or sci-fi stuff. These publishers are doing stuff that's more artsy, more indie, to use an imprecise word. So we were already carrying one or two things from Uncivilized Books, and Uncivilized has a children's imprint called ODOD, which is spelled O-D-O-D. And if you're looking at a cover to Musne, you see like four little dots on the bottom of the cover. That's what that is. That's that word. Mm. So completely independent of Kikkoli making G.I. Joe artwork, I think 8 years ago, we were carrying the first Musne book.
Yeah, it came out simultaneously because we had them print the English in French or in France with the French printers.
Oh, is it?
So it had the same quality. It's the same book. It's just a different black plate that printed the lettering in English. So it's the same exact same book as the French book, printed at the same exact time.
Were you published through Uncivilized because Uncivilized is based in Minnesota?
Minneapolis. I knew Tom K. Yeah. So, and after the, you know, when I think it was before I went to Paris, I can't remember. It must've been the second time. And I met with him and I kind of told him, hey, you know, because I meeting with French publishers and stuff like that kind of made me be like, I might do comics. So I wanted to keep my English rights because the French publishers, for the most part, they want to, you know, take all the, you know, everything. So I kind of held on to English rights because, you know, I was like, well, I already have a publisher here. So, and now it's just like self-publish my own stuff. So, but at the time I was like, I don't want to have to deal with all this stuff. I can barely make art. So I didn't want to have to worry about the publishing end of things. So,
we have our copies of Musne, right next to Carl Barks, Uncle Scrooge, oh, cool. and Donald Duck, and some of the Disney Afternoon reprints that Fantagraphic has been doing, and some of the children's books that that No Brow does through its Flying Eye imprint.
Yeah.
So, you know, for American fans, Musne, these are like European bande dessinée style albums.
Yep.
It's like taller, they're skinny, they're hardcover. These are not quote floppies. Like there is no like trade paperback collection. It's four skinny hardcovers, and you'd think, just looking, you'd think that it's a children's book like Dr. Seuss, as opposed to comics. And then you open it up and they're word balloons.
And again it's like, you know, with spending enough time and learning about all these painters and everything, it was like, how do I don't want to be giving like a history lesson of all these French artists or painters, but I kind of saw it being like, it's going on in the background. The history is going on. And if I can kind of keep that in the background, but me going through my accident and all the stuff that I was dealing with, post-traumatic stress, depression, all this, and then finding out about Monet and what he was going through, I felt like this kinship with him, you know? And so I kind of wanted to build, I was like, we're this mouse in a sense is me, you know, but he's going to have like this, the same kind of, so I didn't need to make the book about Monet as much as it was about Monet. It was about this mouse, which again, it's like the every person, because I was, you know, and then the next series that I want to do is him in Paris. And I think I'd focus on more like Degas and Rodin, who's a sculptor. Because when I was then being paid by the publisher to come and do signings and spend time there, you know, working on the book and everything, I stayed near Rodin's house And it was similar. I was there all the time because it was just right down the street. So I'd go in, and he had this huge garden too. And so I'm just like, you know, all these artists with their gardens. And I was like, well, if Musonet ever came to Paris and studied there, which the second series would take place there, he would be at Rodin. So I'd imagine he'd probably start sculpting then because of all the things and that are there. And then Degas would, you know, I think Degas is, you know, I love Monet, but Degas to me is probably the most well-rounded of all those artists. Like, he could do everything. He could use any kind of medium. He was constantly challenging himself to learn more and more. He didn't settle. You know, he has a famous quote where somebody asked him, "What's your style?" And he said, I'll find my style when I'm dead, you know, because he's pretty much saying, like, you know, after I stop working, you can judge my body of work, and that's what my style will be. But in his head, he had no style. He was just learning and trying to implement. You know, he used oils, then used, you know, engravings, ink, pastels. He was sculpting all the time. He was doing everything. So I'd like to kind of take all the knowledge that I know about him and put him somehow in the book, the same kind of way. So
is this the segue to G.I. Joe? Because I look at your G.I. Joe paintings and I think that looks like gouache. So Mark.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. Yeah.
That was going to be the question. What's this talking about materials? What's the segue to gouache and the work that we know from seeing your G.I. Joe work?
When I was working on Musonet, I did the painted all the covers are fully painted, and the first cover is they're all kind of like a riff on one of Monet's paintings, but I just put the mouse in the painting somehow. But I wanted to recreate them like I was doing studies and stuff. And when you use oil, it's reflective because of how it dries. And so it's hard to scan in oil painting. So that first cover, I knew somewhat about gouache, but I knew it dried flat, like a matte. So it wouldn't be glossy and you could scan it in. And so, but when I used it, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's such a hard medium to use. It never really dries. So it dries, but you can reactivate it with water. So if you don't know what you're doing when you're painting on it, because you paint it, and as soon as you get done painting, you know, like 20 seconds later, it's dry, unless you're keeping it wet somehow. So you have to learn how to paint so you don't reactivate the paint underneath it. And so I stopped using it after that first cover because it just drove me nuts. And then I kind of started figuring out going to like life drawing, because I was doing oil paintings in life drawing class. You know, you go and study a nude for, you know, and they stand there for 5 minutes and then change the pose. And I was oil painting and doing sketches and stuff. And everybody thought I was crazy because they're like, what are you doing with oil paints in here? Normally it's charcoal. And I'm like, I want to get good. You know, I want to get fast and good. You don't have time. You don't have time. The light changes, people move, whatever. So it's just, and I figured out by painting on like a untreated board, the oil would soak into the board and it would dry flat. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, I discovered something here. And so I was able to then, for book 2, 3, and 4 of Musonet, I was able to oil paint, but do it on this board, and it would absorb the oils and the pigment would be left over and it would dry flat. So I was able to scan that in and use it.
You're talking about the covers.
Yeah, for the covers.
The interiors are...
They're kind of a combination of a wash, like a wash of color to create shadows. And then I did simple computer flats for that, because comic books are really hard. If you're going to paint a whole book, like you better make sure there's no corrections, you know, so you'd have to do like a lot of work up front to make sure that the publisher has approved everything before you go into the painting stage, because if there are a few corrections and stuff like that, I didn't want to take that much time. And I, you know, comic books, even for me being an American, I'm used to the system of people wanting it every month, you know, or at least every couple months, where in France, it's, you just put out one 48 page book a year, pretty much, unless you work for different publishers. And for that part, most of those guys are doing it because they're getting advances from different publishers, so it's allowing them to live. You know, if you're getting $20,000 here, $20,000, you know, whatever the advance is, you're working on multiple books at the same time, but they're from different publishers. So because the publisher's not going to really commit to doing a lot of volumes, because they're already, you know, putting out a lot of volumes of everyone's work. So they want to kind of just focus on one book, maybe two books a year maximum from an artist. But with Musnay, I did those four books in about a year. And so it's just kind of like doing computer colors was just easy, because the first book's always the hardest, because you don't know what the color palette is going to be, really, of what, you know, day and night cycles and, you know, what everyone is. So you're able, if I was to paint it, I'd really have to do studies of making sure everything is its color and you're locked into that. Where the computer colors, by the end of the book, I'd go back through and make a final pass and just be like, ah, oh, this is wrong. And you just kind of click and change it. And it's so much easier to do. But I wanted to paint it, right? So if I did a second Musnay series, knowing what I know now, I'd probably do a painted inside, because I'm just comfortable with doing it. But getting back to G.I. Joe now is, when I started using gouache then, or I had an idea of using gouache, but I didn't want to do it because it just was too difficult. And I didn't really have an idea why. But my dad then passed away, like, maybe two or three weeks before Christmas, and my kids were homesick, and I was running up and down from my studio to their bedroom, because they were both sick, and they were like, I'm thirsty, or I need this, or I need that. And so I was like, oh, I'm not going to work at all. I'm like, my dad just passed away, they're sick, I'm just going to watch TV and just take care of them, you know, like that. So I started watching like a couple, YouTube recommended like a couple toy channels or something. And I was like, oh, I had that G.I. Joe when I was a kid. And it was like a restoration video. So I watched them do one, and then I watched another one, and my kids were like, what are you watching out there? And I was like, oh, just come out here and watch with me, you know? And I was, you know, did the old man thing of, these are the toys that I had when I was a kid. You know, this is the best time to be a kid, in my opinion. So we went to Wisconsin then to see my wife's family for New Year's. And they had like a retro toy shop there. And so I was like, let's go in there. Like, I got to see these toys now, because I kind of continued watching a lot of these toy channel stuff. And I picked up a few of these toys, and it was like, wow, it's just like an instant, like I felt the plastic, and that I just remembered. It was weird, because my hand's bigger than when I was a kid. That was the only difference. But I saw Major Blood, and I couldn't remember that he had that mech arm, you know, and it was like a solid piece. And I was like, I don't remember this at all. And I didn't have him. I didn't have that figure as a kid, but I just didn't remember that it was that way. And now getting into, now I know that might drive some people crazy listening. It's not a mech arm, it's armor, you know? But I talked to Ron Rudat, and he confirmed it was designed as a mech arm. So in your face, no. So no, because you get a lot of people. He told me, sorry, Ron. But Ron said, please don't say that I told you. Because he gets it from everybody too, of asking him, is it a mech arm? Because I think Larry designed it, or the way they did it in the comic then, it was just armor, because he was shooting a missile, you know, the missile gun from it, so it's protecting his arm. But yeah, I was just surprised, and I saw a couple Star Wars figures, that I couldn't remember at all, like bounty hunter characters. And I was just like, huh? So my wife was like, don't think about buying any of this stuff. And I was like, don't worry, I'm not going to buy anything. And we went back, and then I was on eBay looking these things up because I'm like, I don't remember this at all. And then I came across this one photo on eBay that was really well done. That was like white background, and these toys were on it, and it just made them look so good. I'm like, oh man, I'm going back there tomorrow and buying these things. Because I started thinking like, well, nobody, I've done all these paintings of, you know, vases and flowers and all this stuff. And I'm like, it doesn't interest me at all other than learning how to paint. But I'm like, I wonder if I could paint these toys. Like, they're plastic, they give a sheen, you know, to it. And I'm like, I'm sure people would want to buy something like that. Like, these are the people, this is my crowd, right? Like what I said before is like, it was hard to try and figure out, like, how do I make that switch from comic books to then painting? It's a complete, you know, the transition of learning the business end was the easiest. It's more or less like, how do I get to this clientele of people wanting to buy paintings, you know, and do I really want to sell paintings to people who are just going to put it in a closet and not even look at it? You know, I want to get to people who actually really love this stuff. So that kind of hit an epiphany to me. And I went back, bought those toys, and we came back home and I started sketching it. And I went around town here looking for other toy shops. And I found this one, and the guy was like, oh, you know, he goes, you should join this one G.I. Joe group. It's really popular on Facebook. And he's like, you should post your art there. So I listened to him, and I went in there and posted, and everybody started freaking out. And so that's kind of, then it was being addicted to buying G.I. Joe toys then.
Let me ask a specific question here, because
yeah,
I can think of two different kinds of G.I. Joe art of yours. One, mm-hmm. maybe three. There's sort of the scene, like the background of the title card that Mark came up with mm-hmm. for this episode. And then there are paintings that look like action figures. And then there are paintings where you are redoing the Hector Greedo package yeah. art. So do you see these three categories as sort of really just one big thing? Are there big differences? Is it like you've moved from one to the other?
Yeah, you know, at first it was just, I was getting these toys and I was looking at them, and like how I was spending all this time in the museum studying all these master painters, I started looking at these toys of, wait a minute, somebody sculpted this, you know, somebody engineered these things. I wasn't looking at it from, you know, an 8-year-old to, you know, 14-year-old kid that was buying this stuff. I was looking at it from a designer perspective and an artist perspective. And so I just, at first, I was just kind of drawing the toys as I saw them, not thinking anything like, oh, this is my style. I'm the guy who draws. No, I was just literally having fun just studying them and seeing.
Yeah, like the first series of G.I. Joe paintings that you did, you know, if you sort of search them out, they look much more like the toy, and you've drawn like rivets in the arms and these kinds
yeah
of
yeah
things.
No, and that, those, you know, those are, that's exactly where I started, and then from there I kind of got bored of it, and I was just like, all right, I don't want to do this, you know, because people were constantly being like, oh, this other guy does that kind of thing, and I'm like, well, I'm not trying to do anything other than just have fun. This is me playing with these toys, I guess, you know, just looking at them. And I'd look at them when I was a kid too, and just look at all the detail and what made these figures the figures and stuff. So in a sense, that's kind of what I was doing. And then looking at all the color theory that they would apply to these characters of, I thought it was so smart, you know, at least for the first 8 years that the line was, you know, then it started getting kind of wonky. But as a kid, I collected till I think 1988, I think was my last figures. And then it just, you know, we went to, after Christmas break, I remember at lunch the first day back, everyone was like, "What'd you get for Christmas?" And all the kids were like, "Well, I got a sweater and a skateboard and a bike." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Didn't anyone get any Joes?" And they're all laughing. And I was like, "Oh my gosh." I'm like, "I'm the only one that got G.I. Joes." And I was like, you know, I was like, "Yeah, just kidding." You know, but in my head, I was like, "Oh no, these guys are all lame. They don't get any toys." So I just remember that.
It's like you've had two ends of innocence.
Yeah.
That day in 88 and then the car accident. It's like when your childhood ended. Because you thought those kids were lame, but did they think you were lame for not getting?
Yeah. Well, they didn't. I don't remember. I just remember saying, like, I was like, this is really sad to hear, like, talking about sweaters and pants and shirts. And, you know, I guess they were getting Nintendo games and stuff. Nintendo was kind of still, you know, not frowned upon. But
the next step. Of toys, isn't it? It's
moved from, yeah, in a sense,
chunks of plastic to pixels. But here's a question for you. So you talked about sort of finding that major blood in the shop, and that waking all of these sort of thoughts and feelings and memories. What happened to your childhood collection?
They went away. My parents split up, and my dad was like, "We're not bringing this stuff with." And I think I was in ninth grade at the time. But even that, I was just like, "I don't want to get rid of this stuff. These are my toys, you know." But we had a garage sale, and this was the saddest part of the story, I guess. I watched all that stuff go away for like pennies, you know. But it just was like, oh well, you know, I kind of moved on. But I was able to, you know, some of the stuff we kept, you know, like some of the figures and stuff. But when I got back into it a few years ago, I called up, I went over to my dad's and stuff, and they got rid of it all. I think my brother's kids probably found it and started playing with it and stuff, and you know, it's all gone.
Were you watching the TV show? Were you reading the comic book?
Yeah, I was more of a cartoon kid. And then when I got back into it, you know, I started seeing the comic and just being like, I can't believe I've never read this, you know? And, you know, I knew about it, but, you know, kids were reading it at school, but I kind of felt guilty that here I'm a comic book artist and I didn't ever read G.I. Joe growing up or Transformers or any of that stuff. And so I started reading that. And I think I was at New York Comic Con, and I was walking by, and it was early in the morning. You know, I get there early so I could walk the floor, because, you know, I have like a artist badge and stuff or a booth badge. And Larry Hama just sat down, and I was like, oh, should I go over and say hi to him? And I was like, nah, just leave him alone. And I was walking, and I was like, nah, I'm gonna go say hi to him. So I went over, and I'm like, what are you doing? I'm like, in my head, I was having all this big, huge dialogue, because I'm like, what am I gonna say to him? It wasn't like, oh, I read your comics growing up. Or do I say, I just started reading your comics? You know, but I love G.I. Joe. But I knew enough. Like, I'd watched some videos with him in it and about the history of everything, and you know, Ron Rudat designing it. And, you know, I was meeting some of these guys or reaching out on Facebook or whatever, and they kind of knew who I was and what I was doing, and they liked it. But I hadn't met Larry. So I went over, and I was just like, what am I doing? Abort, abort, get out of this, you know, turn around. But it was, he locked eyes with me. I was like, oh, it's too late. And he just took a bite of like a muffin or a bagel or something with his coffee. And I'm like, oh, now I'm interrupting his meal right before the show starts. I'm like, And so I was like, hi, you know, I introduced myself, and it was just, it was kind of awkward. I made it awkward. it wasn't his fault. I was just, but in my head, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to say. What do I say? And so I just, you know, I just wanted to say hi to him. And because I learned previously, and why I wanted to say hi to him is because I just didn't realize, like, he's the biggest reason of the success of G.I. Joe. You know, he put in, he took these designs and breathed life into them, you know, and made them characters and gave them their backstories. And, you know, it's the reason why the cartoon was successful is because they took all of his work that they did and, you know, did what they did with it. And so I just wanted to say hi to him. And then I was in Joe Fest, the one that me and Tim met at. Ron Rudat was sitting right next to me, and Larry was sitting on the other side because, you know, they invited me to come down to the show, and I wanted to go. And so I brought some of this artwork with and made some prints and stuff and sold them there. But I made Ron a really nice painting of his of Leatherneck with the explosion. Because I can't remember, did Leatherneck have the explosion background, or did that go to the digital background? Was it digital. The digital? Yeah. So I was like, he needed a proper explosion background. Like, he got gypped. And same with Larry. And so I made them, like, really nice paintings and gave them to them both. And so it was really fun. And when I went into the Joe Fest to check into the hotel, I was going up to the elevator, and the Rudats were right in front of me. And I'm like, oh, do I say anything? You know, it was, again, this is after I met Larry for the first time. And I'm like, I'm not going to say anything to Ron. And so we get in the elevator, and his wife kind of leans into me and whispers. She goes, we're glad to see you. My husband's a big fan. And I was like, wait, what? And so then I said hi to Ron, and he was like, hi, you know. And so then, for the most part, we went out to eat, and we ate breakfast together, everything. It was just so weird, you know, because, again, it's like, after, you know, I would look at these, literally look at these toys when I was a kid, and my mom would always tease me. She would go, you know, she'd tell my kids, because I started getting these toys, and they were playing with them then. My mom was, like, telling them, you know, your dad would always say, you know what the best thing about these figures are is the detail, you know? And so, cause I just look at them and just be like amazed with how they were able to jam that much information into those figures, but still have it be vague. You know, there's like a nice balance of, you know, where you go from the Star Wars figures before that, they always frustrated me as a kid because you couldn't bend their knees, and, you know, the heads, and you turn them would pop off, and it just kind of seemed kind of lame, because you'd look at the card art for Star Wars and you'd have the photo of Luke Skywalker, and you look at the figure next to it and you'd be like, that looks nothing like Luke Skywalker. It's so vague. Where the G.I. Joe, I remember going down the aisle for the first time, and it was just like seeing that explosion background was just like, whoa, what the heck is this? And it just was like, I was done with everything else. And it was like, this is what I want, you know? And going back to what you were asking of how I started using gouache, that's when I recognized, when I started looking at the box art or the card art, I started seeing like, wait a minute, this is gouache paint, because this wouldn't be oil. It's doing things that gouache would do with my small experience of using it. I was like, I need to start using this paint. And that's when I started doing what I did it in Paris. I just started studying Hector Garrido's art, his paintings, and trying to recreate it. And that then in turn, it's kind of like a two-folded thing of, I'm going to study Hector Garrido and I'm going to learn how to use gouache paint. So that then was, I started doing that and putting after Garrido, And everybody was like, what does that mean, after Garrido? And so then I started championing him, being like, this is the guy who nobody knows about that influenced your whole childhood. When you walk down that lane, because most of the people that I talked to had the same exact experience. They were going into the store for something else, and then they went down this aisle, and it was like, what is this explosion stuff? I want that. And it just was a complete game changer. It was brilliant. I'd imagine Kirk Bazigian had a big, huge, you know, like all everything. It was like all the things, you know, from Larry doing all the information on the back, Ron designing these really cool figures and Cobra logo and all this stuff. And then you have this painter that was able to do this kind of stuff. It just, it hit in all. And, you know, I guess the sculptor, I forget the sculptor's name, like that worked on a lot of the stuff.
Here's a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you certain the original paintings are gouache? Are they not acrylic?
No, it's gouache. Because when I was at that Joe Fest, they had an original there that was torpedo. And I went up to it, and as soon as I went up to it, because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, I wonder if you use different kind of paint. Nope, it's gouache. It's gouache. Because I've used enough of it now where this was a medium that was used during, you know, advertising era. It dries so quick and it's matte. And it's very easy to correct, you know, if you need to make a change and correct something, it dries super quick. Where oil, again, it takes weeks to dry. Acrylic, I don't know. Acrylic has a plasticky look when it dries, and it's also reflective. Now, they've made new paints that are acrylic gouache, but I don't think they had acrylic gouache back then. Acrylic gouache is same thing, but the acrylic gouache, when it dries, you can't reactivate the pigment with water. It's dry when it dries. Where the gouache that I use, it's, if you get it wet again, it'll reactivate. So Hector Garrido's granddaughter reached out to me after seeing this painting that you have up. And she was like, thank you for doing this. And she let me know that he got a copy of this. And he was really happy that before he died, he goes, I don't want to start crying, but he said he was really touched, and he didn't know if anyone would ever remember him from the work that he used to do. And this made him feel happy that someone did. So made me feel good. So I sent her the original art that I did. And then I did another piece when he passed of all the G.I. Joe walking down. There it is, honoring him. And you can see the Argentine flag behind Gung. I think that might be Gung Ho there. So. But yeah, she was really happy with this. And, you know, I was like, I'm never going to sell this piece or the other piece. So I sent it to her to stay in the family.
Wow. We often ask people what G.I. Joe is to them, whether it's the toys, the cartoons, the comics first and foremost. And hearing this, the stories that you've talked from another interview you did, talking about sort of the experience of going into the shops, it almost feels like it was the card art first and foremost,
yeah,
that made you the G.I. Joe fan, that you might go into the shop thinking you'd buy one figure, mm-hmm, and then coming away with something entirely different just based on the reaction to the art on the front of the card.
Yeah. The cartoon, you know, got me hyped. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, I want this character. You know, I want Snake Eyes, or, you know, I my first figure was Snake Eyes, 82. And I remember I have four brothers, so I'm second to the youngest. So there's five of us. And my middle brother came home with, I think it was, must have been Flash, the Jump Pack, you know, like the platform with Beck, which I can't remember if Grand Slam, I think Grand Slam came with that, right?
That's right. Yeah, with the silver.
So we had the silver or the version. Red. Yeah, it was the silver or the red, but I'm pretty sure it was the silver version. And then Snake Eyes 82 and a Cobra Officer. Well, my brother was like, which one do you want? I picked Flash. So I was like, well, I'm picking Snake Eyes. I would have picked Snake Eyes anyways, black. You know, it's always my favorite color, if that's a color. And then my youngest brother got stuck with the Cobra Officer. So, but, you know, that was already, because I remember getting back into the toys and seeing the ninja version of Snake Eyes. But I was like, how come I never got this? It's just because I already had, in my kid brain, it was like, I already have Snake Eyes. Why do I need another Snake Eyes? And his hand broke. So then I gave him Chewbacca's gun, which had that little clip, you know, on, so it would hold into it. So I was like, that was his gun then. But yeah, it's the card art. I would say, yeah, the cartoon, I loved watching the cartoon, but the cartoon was just the cartoon, right? You just come home and cartoons was on. So it was fun to watch it. But yeah, the card art. I remember, I didn't really remember as a kid, but psychologically, when they did go from the explosion to that digital explosion, it kind of did, it took me out of it psychologically. I wasn't as interested. And so that must have been, what, 86?
Wow.
86 that they did that. So 87, 88. But, you know, I was still into it because of the cartoon. And then the movie came out. And I remember watching that being like, what the heck am I watching? It was, you know, monsters. And, you know, I draw like a lot of monsters and creatures now. And I think it was because of that. Because it was like... Weirdly, I wanted to stop watching it, but I couldn't look away kind of deal. And I just thought, I was like, oh, especially at the end when all the whole Cobra Law is transforming and all the bugs are coming out and slugs and everything, you know, all the creatures and stuff. And I was just like, I didn't know what to make of it, but I did kind of like it, you know. But then it totally changed, right? With the Deke version. That's when I was completely out, because they changed the whole intro and the song, and the voices weren't really the same. And I was just like, "Yeah, I'm done." So
got to get tough.
Yeah, I got to get tough. Yeah, now I hear that song and I'm like, yeah, it's not bad. It's kind of fun, you know.
I've interviewed the guy who sang that.
Oh yeah, cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Did he sing it for you live? Did he do Did he do a live singing of it?
No, but he is alive. He's in California.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I often think what it like when I hear the original G.I. Joe, because you hear the commercial versions of when they did the comic, you know, promoting the comic on the commercials, and then you hear some of the iterations of then the toy commercial ones, and then you get the cartoon or the first miniseries version. And you know, the guys who are singing, I don't know if it's one guy or a couple guys or like how they did that, but you can tell like there's a change. But I always think about wonder, because he just, you know, the way his voice is, he kind of sounds I don't know, it's kind of seems it's cool how it came together. But I often think about him whenever I hear him singing. Wonder what it was like when he was singing this in the recording studio. It's too bad they don't have video or doc. I'd like to put together a documentary on something like that. But
Kigali, I hesitate to try and put these two things together, lest the magic spell be broken. But you make comics.
Yep.
You paint G.I. Joe art.
Uh-huh.
And there's a company out there which puts G.I. Joe art on packages. And there's another company out there which makes G.I. Joe comics.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, I
could. With, could that happen? Are you interested?
It could. It could. I don't know. It's for something like with how everything's ever happened with me. I've always kind of just gone with the flow. I haven't forced anything. The few things that I've forced, I've always regretted being like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have, you know, now I have, I'm in this and I have to finish it. So I've kind of learned like, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen, you know, but I'm not going to sit there and champion and go to these companies and ask to be in it. They all know who I am. They all know what I'm doing. It's a very small world. I see on my Instagram and story modes that people are checking out my stuff, you know. So it's, if they want me to, I'd love to. I always said, like, I'd love to work with Larry, you know. To me, G.I. Joe is, he's G.I. Joe. He knows all these characters. He's based them all on people he knows. I don't know how you can write these characters yourself without making something completely new. And it seems like this is what Skybound's doing with their side projects that Larry isn't doing, is they're just making, it's almost like a cartoon, like what the cartoons did from the comic book. They're kind of doing that with their lines of things. So yeah, I'd love to, you know, people are always saying you should do box art and stuff, and it's like, I know Hasbro knows who I am, so if they just have to ask, like, I'd love to do it, you know, it'd be fun. It's, you know, I do this stuff for the fun of it, you know. I'm goofing around. It went from, like, so this is the last painting or the last drawing that I did of the last series. I've been kind of working my way through the years of G.I. Joe, and this was 1986, the 1986 line. It's just me goofing around and having fun. Again, I love this stuff. It's my favorite toy line. You know, I had He-Man or some He-Man. I had Star Wars before, but as soon as G.I. Joe was there, it was game over, you know. And it's fun to come back to it and goof around and try things out. This is where I kind of experiment on things, especially like computer coloring or painting. You know, this whole series was kind of a combination of painting and computer coloring. So I was kind of just, you know, where it's a little bit harder, like I was saying with Musne or the things that I create for myself, it's, you don't have much time to work on things. You know, you got to get them done quickly. So there's not a lot of experimenting going on. So this, at least, I can work on one of these pieces a day and kind of just try something and see how it works. And then the next one begets the next. And going from first drawing, kind of just studying the toys and making it look like the toys, getting bored with that, and then going, okay, I'm going to start drawing this stuff on its own. And now I'm to the point where I'm just kind of making story. The last two series, I started just making story of, you know, kind of in the background, you know, of these characters and stuff like that. So I don't know where it might go to, but yeah, that would make the most logical sense, is doing something official for Hasbro or for Skybound.
In looking at this, all these images that Mark has put up, my brain is trying to find a place where they fit historically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, so, you know, the ones that are after Garrido package paintings look like Garrido package paintings, that makes sense. The ones that are definitely drawings of toys, I can imagine an artist sitting at a desk or a table with toys in front of them. Some of them, like this one and that one from the end of the movie looking downward, mm-hmm. feel like to me like storybooks, like those painted, like Earl Norum did a bunch of them in the 80s, where there's text, text on the left side and like a painting mm-hmm. on the right side. And and I'm fascinated that in one like this, Serpentor is so tight, this becomes like finger quotes, sort of normal comic book illustration. It's this like American adventure style comic book illustration. There's thick lines, there's thin lines, there's some spotted blacks, there's like a little bit of contrapposto. But then like that Arctic scene with is it Scarlet or Lady J, and there's a kid in the road, in the middle of the road. Snow cat with all the polar assault troopers. Like that one, like there are a couple lines in sort of the backpacks of the Cobra Arctic troopers that it's like it just becomes so gestural, or like the outline of one becomes sort of the outline of another, and it like starts to, I don't say this in an insulting way, like sort of fall apart or like break up. It's like, no, I can see where this is more gestural,
abstract,
impressionist. I'm seeing the artist's hand, I'm seeing the marks. Like there's that line all the way on the right side, which on screen right now lines up sort of with your head and shoulders. That's like kind of the backpack outline, and I just see like a giant brush dab of ink. And these so many of these images sort of like shimmer, they like shift from being a real story moment in my imagination or in a real place to being like maybe a moment from an animated commercial for the toys, or like I see an artist like definitely painting an action figure and a vehicle, whether or not they're rivets. It's like something about the amount of detail or the proportions. So it's a very long way of saying I like.
Well, no, and that's kind of, you know, from where I started with, you know, studying the figures, like I said, they're vague, but they have like a lot of detail in them too. And it might be from how, you know, because when they originally, the sculptor originally sculpted it, they were probably like 6-7 inches. And then they got rotoplaned or whatever that system is to make them a smaller figure. And so there's this loss of detail because of, you know, taking this giant thing that isn't, you know, from Blender, you know, it's an actual sculpture that they then use this technology to make it then a smaller figure that they could make a mold or a cast out of. It's like each one of those generations that probably lost detail upon it. And then, you know, me studying all these impressionist painters and, you know, abstract painters and stuff like Picasso or Manet, or, you know, it's like Matisse, I should say. It's just all this stuff kind of melded into what it is and brought me back, you know, when I came back into toys. It just that was kind of more of the thing that, like I said, I see this stuff as art, and these guys who were making it were very intelligent. You know, they're making things for kids. But they're intelligently problem solving coming up with solutions to make it simple so it works, right? And so it's cost effective for the company to mass produce these product. And, you know, you have all these engineers and whatnot making toys. So,
I was going to say, on the other end of the scale, you've sort of also done like a handful of paintings, which are sort of more in this style that I've just put on the screen, which sort of feels to me like it's closer to that promotional, you know, painted art that was being done. And Tim will probably be able to better describe where that was all used. Yeah. But it's a much more, it feels much more like a painting, you know, action scene, which I'm guessing you were trying to emulate some of the look of those paintings.
That was a massive, that was the biggest thing I ever did. That was like, it was like 4 feet tall by 6 feet wide. It's just gigantic. What? Yeah. Yeah. This one artist commissioned this, Dave Cho. He commissioned me to paint that. Yeah. So I like that took me, I was like, okay, I'm going to actually take my time. And it took me 2 months to do, you know.
How do you,
I was like,
this is the Facebook billionaire David Cho, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he reached out. I had a mutual friend, and I was like, you know, because he just reached out through Instagram, was like, hey, I stumbled upon your work. He read Purdy, my comic book Purdy, and he was like, hey, I just want to let you know, like, this is the best comic I've read in a long time. And he goes, I love your pop culture stuff. Could you do a painting for me? And so I had a friend that knew him, and I was like, okay, somebody's pulling my leg here. And so I just reached out to my friend. He was like, no, that's him. I'm like, oh, okay.
I got to jump in here. 4 feet by 6 feet?
Yeah, this is probably from old Instagram because it makes it a square. There's missing pieces on the other side. But yeah, it's big.
No, I just need to say this for our listeners and viewers. You know, a comic book is like 7 by 10, like 10 inches.
Yeah.
And a regular standard like Marvel Comics poster at your comic book store is 2 feet by 3 feet. And this is twice as wide and twice as long as a standard. Just shipping this would be a beast.
Yeah, it was a pain. Like I went to Home Depot and bought some of this pressed, it's not wood, it's not cardboard, it's something in between. It's like this pressed fiber board or something. And I had them cut it, and I just shipped it. Sandwiched in that, and then I sandwiched it in cardboard on the outside and shipped it so it wouldn't bend. And yeah, it was a pain, but yeah, that took about 2 months to do, but it was fun. That's all I worked on too. I was like every day I was sitting there looking at how do I do this, how do I do that. It's the explosion, the parts that's missing. I'm looking at it, so it's on my right where you can see where Quick Kick is on the bottom, and then it goes to Stalker, and then it goes to Jinx, and then I think Beachhead might be in there, and then it's Spirit. I don't know who's getting crapped out there, but there's more on that side because there's a bunch of bats, like they're coming up on this on the left side. There's just as many bats on the other side. And then there's a few trouble bubbles in the air, and the explosion is on the other side.
Presumably so, you took a good photo, not for Instagram.
Yeah, no, I scanned it all in. Yeah, I scanned it all in.
In 10 in parts? Little,
yeah, it's like it's got to be at least 14, wow. 14 scans. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Because I've got a 13 by or a big... big huge Canson scanner, so it took that many times. Yeah, it was a pain to scan in, but yeah, I was like, I don't want to ship this and not have a good scan of this just in case something happens to it. So, but this is where I learned, because I did this on gouache too, this is where I learned I probably should have used oil, because there's certain limitations to gouache. Like once you kind of start getting a little too big, it's very hard to have the pigment flow the way you want to, because I'm wanting to make a brush stroke and it's dry by the time the brush stroke ends, you know, the paint is dry. So it would have been nice to have it still be wet, that you could kind of go wet into wet, or even if you're working on it for a few months, like you have some tacky stuff or you have some dry stuff and you can kind of go wet over dry and all that. So I don't know. It was a fun, fun painting to do. Yeah, that was fun. Cause again, I was still learning I'd like to do another big one. I've got ideas of giant G.I. Joe paintings, you know, where I do like a whole season of, cause again, it's like me focusing on these seasons of, like I said, just finished 1986. It's fun to kind of go through and be like, look at it from a standpoint of this is the cast that was put out, you know, look at the cartoon during that time, look at the comic books during that time promoting that, look at all the commercials that were coming out, and just kind of see holes, you know, of like, I would have did it like this. And that's kind of what I've learned by doing this, is like, well, I'm just going to do that. I'm going to kind of sneak in there and just kind of plop my little ideas that don't I hope that I enhance the experience instead of, you know, just being like, I'm just going to do it my way.
What I see here is a mixture of 82 up through 86 characters, mm-hmm. which is not really something that we would have seen on the cartoon, because there were memos sent to Los Angeles that said, don't include these older characters. Because they're not available for sale anymore. We're not promoting that. So just to see Scarlet and Stalker with some 86 bats, my brain is slightly folding to make room for it.
Well, also, this was Dave's, like, he gave me a list. I said, who's your favorite characters? And he gave me this list. So I was like, that's what I'm going to use, you know? So I played around with his favorite. And Quick Kick was his ultimate favorite character. So I had him front and center kind of deal, you know, even though he's backing up. But I you know, in the cartoon, I remember he was kind of, I don't know, he's kind of like comedy relief, you know, kind of handled that way. So, but yeah.
I was going to say, you were talking about sort of making story and sort of crafting story in this latest set of 20 or so that you did. And definitely this image is what came to mind about you definitely playing with story, that we've got this snake, four-breasted snake creature on this operating table.
The first one never works properly. You know, watching that, the first miniseries, or the miniseries that they were making Sepenter, the first version of him was like a monster or whatever. So I was like, well, they're making a Sepentress, you know, queen for him. It's not going to turn out, you know. And, you know, it's more the background story that's going on, because you have Snake Eyes picking up Jinx, and then Cover Girl, the blonde version of Cover Girl, which I always liked better, because she looked different, right? It was just like, I'm just kind of goofing around and telling the story. I always thought Dr. Mindbender is always kind of weird with his getup of no shirt and the suspender things and a cape, you know. But I was like, I didn't want to give him a cape because he's working, you know. So I don't know, it's just me goofing around and just having fun with the idea of like, what would you walk into? Snake Eyes, you know, the story started becoming with this last series is they infiltrated the Terradrome on Cobra Island, and as it went on, they first rescued Sergeant Slaughter in a piece previous this, and that made me start thinking like, well, why was Sergeant Slaughter in the jail? And then I kind of was going further, because I'm like, at some point I know I'm going to get to Dr. Mindbender, right? And we're going to be in his lab. So and initially I had General Hawk up there instead of Cover Girl, but when I drew the Sepentress, I just started drawing. I was like, oh, that would be funny if they're making, because I was like, what are they making? And it's kind of listening to Larry talk, it's kind of how I work too. And I kind of feel akin to him as well. It's just like one thing begets the next. It's the fun of it is seeing how what happens with it. It's not, this is my idea, I'm writing it, I can't deviate from this thing, it has to be this, I can't change it at all. Because once you start getting into that, the piece becomes very boring, and it's very boring and laborious to work on something this long and not have it be fun. So the last two things that I changed was A, the Sepentress, once I that formed, because it was just a blob there that I had. I just kind of drew this blobby human shape. And then as soon as I gave it the four breast kind of thing, I was like, oh, it's a Sepentress, you know? And then I was like, oh, General Hawk needs to change in the background. It needs to be. And I was like, oh, I want to draw the blonde Cover Girl. But I always laugh now because I drew Sergeant Slaughter being, so it was, is Sergeant Slaughter's DNA in Sepentress as well? I don't know, probably. Sorry.
Okay. Two process questions. One, what kind of paper is this? Or what kind of paper do you work on?
It's this stuff when I started drawing sports, or when I actually started drawing, like during the pandemic hit, and they canceled the Minnesota State Fair, which Minnesota State Fair is like this big, huge, it's probably the biggest state fair in the whole country. We have a location that it's a ghost town throughout the whole year, except for when the state fair happens. It's kind of like Spirited Away. If you've ever seen that Miyazaki movie where she goes into this town and then at night it starts to come alive. That's the way this location is for the Minnesota State Fair. They use it for other things, but it's really creepy when you go in there because it's just abandoned, like this abandoned town. You know, they canceled that. And I was like, oh no, I've gone to the state fair now every year for 40 some years since I was, since I was born. And I was kind of like, well, I'm going to start doing paintings of this place. And then it got to the point where I was like, you know what, I could probably make a really cool book where it makes it feel like you're walking through the state fair anytime you want, like a coffee table book. So I did that. And I've gone now and painted there live, you know, did the same thing where I'd go and paint. And that led me kind of into sports because I started painting because I'd stopped going to Paris the last time was 2019 and then the pandemic hit and I hadn't been back since. So I started painting sports and I just started using this paper that my printer had that I was like, this seems like a nice paper. It's not meant to be painted on or anything per se, but I just liked how the paint absorbed into it. And so I just started using that. Now I kind of use it for everything. I use it for...
What is it?
Just this... here's my latest one that I'm drawing here before you guys came up.
Okay.
But it's just this paper. I don't know what it's I have to look, but...
It's not Bristol.
No, but it kind of has a Bristol quality. Like when I'd ink on it and use like a nib and stuff, it doesn't tear, it doesn't gum up the nib at all. It has like a really hard surface, and it's some Bristol that I've used, you know, it absorbs moisture at a certain point, and it would always annoy me. And even trying to paint on Bristol, is it, every once, you know, sometimes you'd get some paper that it was good, but sometimes you'd get paper and it wouldn't react the same. So I knew this paper, if I started using it, like it's consistent because printers are printing on it. So I just started, again, experimenting on it. It's not perfect, but I just got used to it. And...
Okay, second process question. And I think I know the answer to this. Photos of your paintings often have your hand holding a brush.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, because too many people started taking my work and they would send me like, they'd go, hey, look at this t-shirt I made. And I'm like, I didn't make t-shirts of that. They're like, yeah, I made myself one. I just took it off the internet and made it. And I'm like, I didn't make any money. You know, it's like, it's kind of stealing, no? And they're like, I'm a big fan of your work. Or people would then send me photos of their toy thing or whatever, and they'd have all my work all over the walls, and they'd just print out the image, you know, because I'd put up JPEGs and stuff, and they'd just print it out, and they're like, "I'm a big fan. Look at you're all over my toy room or whatever," and I'm like, "You didn't buy any of that." So then I just started taking photos of me with my hand in it, because I figured, well, if they're going to print this out, it's going to have my hand in it. So I don't know.
Could your watermark instead be a photo of you like this?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Like on the bottom right?
It's a part of the game, right? It's like, you know, I try not to get too upset about it. I don't know. I just decided that I wouldn't put such nice scans up. You know,
right. Before we started the formal interview, we were asking you a little bit about your studio, mm-hmm. and you were pointing out a bunch of manga by two or three key manga people on two shelves behind you and a bunch of art books.
Yep.
And then you turned your camera and we saw a vamp, a hiss, and a terror drone. Can you give us a little tour of your studio? You can stay seated if you want, but could you perhaps turn your screen a little bit and just point out some things?
Oh, here we go, this way. Well, I got part of my books here, and then around that corner, that brown there, there's another bookshelf that goes that way. That's more of my European stuff. And then, let's see here, I've got a whole stack there on the ground of in my long boxes, and yeah, my toys are, let's see here, you can see my desk here, and the toys that I have, and then you can see all the cabinets that I have of all my toys and stuff.
But, and your kids are not allowed in here?
No, they're allowed, but you know, they're older now. I had a flag set up in here, and you know, they were playing with that. I'd always kind of say, you know, don't mash this stuff together. You know, to remind them it's a 30-year-old plastic, you know, it's not going to fare well. But they have good memories with it too. That was kind of the fun part is when I started collecting again, they were still young enough that they were right at that perfect age of to be able to play with it. You know, my daughter and my son. And so they had, you know, my daughter quickly went to all the girl Joes, you know, and Baroness and stuff. And she had, you know, she was having fun playing with those too. So I, you know, it made me feel good to be like, oh, okay, we have some kind of connection between my childhood and their childhood. Because hearing them play in the background when I was drawing, it's just like, it's the same sounds, it's the same noises, it's the same scenarios. Because I gave them the comics to read and stuff, and the neighbor kids, they were into Transformers before. And so once my son started showing them G.I. Joe and stuff, they were like, what the heck is this? And so I made them a deal. I gave them those IDW hardbound collections. And I said, okay, if you read the first two volumes, you can come back. And I had it like from Wild Finds and from people sending me a bunch of toys and stuff like that for in trade for drawings and whatnot. I had amassed a pretty big toy collection quick. But I, you know, from some of the Wild Finds, I'd have, you know, semi, they weren't beaters, but they were nice enough for like a kid to use. So I told them, I said, well, if you read some of these comics and you come back and you answer some of these questions that I have for you that I know that you read the comics, you guys can pick a few figures, you know? And so they came back and they were like, oh, and they read them and they liked, you know, I wanted to get them to read the comics first because, again, I felt guilty of not ever reading the comics before. So they picked like the one neighbor kid, he really loved Storm Shadow. So he picked the Storm Shadow, you know, and I was like, yeah, you can pick whatever ones. And so it was fun. Then they would play G.I. Joe and use Transformers and all this stuff. So, yeah, I felt good of like, I'm getting the next generation into this stuff. So.
Okay, so we have talked about two out of four big quadrants of your work. We haven't really talked about sports art, and we haven't really talked about Purdy, but as a more general question, what are some things you are working on now besides that you can talk about besides more fun G.I. Joe paintings?
Yeah, G.I. Joe, like I was thinking before the interview, I'm like, well, a lot of the stuff, I guess, what people are seeing of my stuff on social media is the stuff that I, you know, I don't mind sharing to the world, you know, where everything else that I'm working on, I don't show anybody this stuff. Like I do tons of work all day. And so it's fun to be able to at least be able to post something and have fun and have a response. But right now I'm working on a comic called Tiempos Finales, which was my also previous, the first thing I've ever worked on through the pandemic and stuff, I started thinking, I've always been thinking about these characters. You know, it was an option through Focus Features and Universal Studios to be turned into a movie, live action movie, and all this stuff. And going through all that, it was kind of strange to see how the whole system works, and to say the least. And I've always thought, like, how would I do this if I ever did this again as a comic? And with the whole pandemic and stuff, started making me think about it, and it got me back into drawing the character. And then I was like, I'm gonna start working on this book. So I did the first 30-40 pages of it, and then I got COVID, and it reactivated. It didn't give me any of the symptoms other than the pains that I had from the car accident. So like for like 2 weeks, I was like aching in all the spots that I forgot that I was hurt from. And I was just laying down and just being like, oh, this is not fun. It wasn't as much pain, but it still hurt. And I was like, I'm sick of being in my studio all the time. All I do is I come here, I work 12, 14 hours a day, and I see my family, but it's just, I want to do something else. And my brother had season tickets for the local NHL team, the Minnesota Wild. And he said, hey, they have a 10 game home stretch. Do you want to come to some of these games? Because they're during the week and I can't really find people to be able to come during the week. And since, you know, I work from home or from my studio home, you know, it's pretty much like most people in my family think I don't work at all. I'm just up here goofing around. So I was like, yeah, I'll come to some of these games. And so I always bring my sketchbook with. And so I just started sketching the game, and everybody behind me then was just like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And then the next game, I was like, I wonder if I could bring my paints. Like, can I paint sports at the same time as, you know, as it's going on? So I just started doing that, and I could, you know, that's what I learned. And everybody behind me was taking photos and videos of me doing this. And I wasn't really paying attention to that because I was trying to get the painting done, but it started kind of really blowing up here locally. And then news channels reached out and they're like, are you really doing this live during the game? Can we follow you around with cameras and stuff? I'm like, yeah. And they'd come and follow me around for two or three paintings. And they're like, okay, we got enough. And I'm like, well, I'm just getting warmed up. You know, you didn't even get a good painting. You got some of my, you know, and they're like, nope, we got enough. We got to go. So they didn't even stick around for the whole game. And yeah, it's just then the team started asking me, and the Vikings made me their official artist for not this last season, but the season before. And, you know, I painted for the PGA, golf, NHL, MLB, you know, there I am in the broadcast booth, you know?
Okay. So I think some of our listeners and viewers understand freelance illustrators who do work for clients, like there's an article in a magazine and there needs to be like a caricature of like a movie director, or like maybe, you know, like there was a set of like baseball cards 20 years ago, like yeah. The Chase set was like artwork, it was like computer enhanced artwork, but not mm-hmm. just photos.
Yeah.
This feels either from a different planet or like just very 1940s and 1950s. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure like where to put this, because I don't have a lot of examples of big institutions hiring artists to do this kind of work. So where is your work getting reproduced? And like, what are the, not like what's the deal, like what's your contract, but what are your discussions when, can we do that first one? Where is this artwork going?
For the most part, it goes in my studio in a big stack in my closet, you know, because so, again, it's like everybody wants to buy these things, but I'm also like, well, do I really want to sell my rookie season paintings right now? Like, do I really want to do that? like just understanding sports and baseball cards or any of that stuff. It's like, that's the stuff that's going to be worth a lot in like 10 years when all these, but then I say that and I've given a lot away to the players, rookies who got their first hit or home run or, you know, or a big moment like for a player. It went to the player and they said, it's awesome. I sent it to my mom, you know, and meaning she's going to take care of it. And then, because then we had the Minnesota Twins who they won two World Series and all these old guys that won the World Series are kind of still around here. Kent Herbeck and, you know, Tim Laudner and Dan Gladden and stuff. And I kind of get to meet some of these old guys. But these guys are like royalty because they're the only team around here that's won. Everybody else has not won a championship. So they're telling me like, you know what? A lot of these players, they won't really appreciate what you're doing until they're retired because they can't really it's probably really strange. And I've been thinking about it because I don't approach like anything. Like I told you, I'm not approaching Hasbro or any comic book company and saying, hey, can you please let me work for you? Look at my work or my portfolio. I don't care about any of that. The thing that I care about is doing a good job and having fun doing it. That's it. I don't care about fame. I don't care about making the money. I don't care about any of that. After the accident, it's like I said, all my perspectives changed. And everything that I was doing in the old life, my old artist life, it wasn't like I was doing that, but trying to figure it out. I was having all these examples in front of me of like, do you do it like this? Do I do it like that? And it's kind of like, not. And I was maybe trying to do that, but even in my old life, like all the publishers wanted me to work for them, Marvel, DC, all these French companies, you know, Europe, Asian places. And I would say no. And when I was laying in bed after the car accident, I had 3-4 months laying in bed thinking about all the decisions that I made. And I was thinking, should I have done that? Was I wrong? And that's all I thought about for 4 months because I couldn't do anything. And, you know, it wasn't a good place to be in. But so then I was like, okay, I'll work with publishers then after the car accident. You know, when they approached me, I was like, okay, I'll work. But the first thing that I saw was like, no, I was right. I want to do this by myself. It doesn't really matter about being in every bookstore or everyone knowing who I am or being whatever fame or money or any of that stuff. It's like at the end of the day, did I make something really cool? Did I have fun doing it? Did it mean something to me? And that's it. I don't care if people like this or not. I'm having fun. And this is what the sports stuff is. These people cannot figure me out worth anything. They don't understand me because I'm not trying to do things for self-gain and for money. And it does not, they don't know what to do with it. They come at me and I say, this is what I want. I just want access.
There's this kind of a through line from the sort of sports stuff that you're doing to, and looking at the kind of the G.I. Joe stuff that you're doing to me, because there's this thing of fun there that if you know, someone says, can you draw me Snake Eyes? And they just draw a cool pose of Snake Eyes like this. And, you know, can you draw me Baroness? And it's just, you know, Baronet. But when you're being asked for these commissions, you're going over and above all these. You're not just drawing. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm around and it's like, I'm trying to pay respect to Larry, to Kirk, to Ron Rudat, to Hector Garrido, to all these guys that worked on it that got no credit. You know, it's like these guys dumped their lives into this stuff. You know, they spend all their life doing this stuff. I don't want to come in and crap on it. Like I told you, the thing that I learned the most was from Monet's Garden, where I was just like, wait a minute. I have to be very careful here. Like, this isn't about me coming in here and being like, oh, you know, I'm going to try and get known or whatever. It's like, no, this is about this person, and I need to make sure that it's about them and not about me, you know? And it's lifting them up. I was interviewed by a person in the Monet's Garden for their little newspaper, and she asked me, she was like, and this was after like this big, huge tour that I went on. I was super exhausted. And we're sitting down on this bench in front of Monet's house in the garden before they opened it up for the general public. And she was interviewing me and she goes, do you think Monet would be proud of what you did? And I don't know if it was because I was super tired. I just started crying, you know, because I was like, it just caught me off guard because I thought about him seeing what I was doing. You know, so again, it's that kind of same thing of how I'm approaching this. I don't know. I'm assuming all these guys, you know, I've kind of pulled myself back from getting to know people or anything because it just, I don't know. At the end of the day, what am I going to do? But I hope that they see what I'm doing as being respectful to them. And again, it's trial and error of things. It's like I get a goofy idea, I do it. You know, I just see, you know, it's like, I don't know. But for the most part, it's the same thing with the sports stuff. Is like, you know, these people, these athletes, I don't want to be their friends. You know, I'm not trying to make them buy anything or get any certain kind of favor from them. I'm just trying to do a good job. That's all.
There was I saw an interview with you where you said that a lot of people call you fast because clearly you produce this stuff at an astonishing rate that I think would boggle the mind of most artists, and it's incredible. But I think you had I don't know if you can remember what you said to that, but you said that you'd prefer to be thought of instead of being fast
accurate. Accurate.
Hmm.
Yep. Yeah. I like to be accurate, and it's like I put in my homework. You know, a lot of the sports stuff, it's not just going to the field and just busting out a painting. You know, it's like I put in a lot of effort before, like studying the players and their body language and their movement and how they wear their uniform and everything. Like I have some drawings, like at some point I want to take this art and I want to have a gallery of like prep work. Because I have things where I study pitchers enough where you could make an animation of their pitch, you know. I draw every second of their pitch, you know, of their follow through and everything. So when I'm at the game, when they're pitching, I don't have to think about it. I can just see it and draw it. You know, I don't have to worry about it. I already studied them. So it becomes a little bit of a magic trick when somebody behind me is watching me do this and they just see it just happen, right? It's like these ball players that get out there and they hit a home run, but they spend all this time batting practice and doing all this stuff and all year long and working out. It's muscle memory at the end of the day.
Is it a similar thing to when you're drawing G.I. Joe that you kind of have maybe looked at the figure, turned it around in your head, committed it to memory, and like, I can put that aside now and I can just reproduce what's in my mind on the paper.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, when you put up like the image of the baseball stuff of a whole, you know, whole season of like, you know, a few hundred pieces that I did. And then you go to the G.I. Joe one where it's, you know, I have a whole, you know, yeah, I do a few hundred G.I. Joe drawings. You know, then all the sketches that people are asking me to do and stuff. I just had recently, like this one guy, I won't name him, but he was in a private message. He's like, I really like your work. He goes, and I want to commission you, but I got burned the last two commissions that I had done. So he's like, I'm just kind of like, I don't know if I want to have you do a commission because just so you know, like I'm going to go all out. You tell me who your favorite figures are, a vehicle or whatever, and you're going to get something cool. And he's like, and then a few days later I posted something else and he just said, all right, I'm going to do it. And then, so I did it. I haven't posted that one yet, but he wanted Snake Eyes and Scarlet. And then I've been kind of having like this weird little story going on with Snake Eyes and Scarlet, even in my sketches. And they've been sneaking into this Cobra lair too. And so it was just this progression of that. And so he got one little, because to me, these little things are 6x8s. And, you know, I'm doing paint, they're painted pieces. And I'm not charging that much for them. You know, they should be like $500-$600 paintings, you know, but I'm not charging that much, but it's fun to do them. So I'm like, well, I don't care. It's like, you're going to get something cool out of this. And also for me, it's just like, it just keeps me doing it, right? If you really like me doing G.I. Joe and stuff, you know, support the stuff that I'm doing and I'll keep doing it. I keep thinking like at the end of doing a series like this, like I'm done, I'm not going to do it anymore. Then a few months will go by and I'll be like, I miss these guys. I want to kind of sketch. I don't know what it would be like. I constantly think like, well, would it be like working with Larry on the comic? You know, would it be a good thing? Would it be a bad thing? You know, again, it's like the reason I made it awkward just because of what was going on in my head. And I couldn't spit out like what I wanted to say, cause I didn't know what I wanted to say. And, you know, he was very nice, and it's, you know, like Ron Rudat, like I've talked to him, but again, I pulled back from him too. It's just, I just want to keep this stuff. You know, I'm kind of almost probably protecting myself of like, I don't want a bad experience to happen with G.I. Joe. Cause I don't want to have like this taint on what, you know, of my love for it, you know?
Even as I was asking you that question earlier about working perhaps for Hasbro or Skybound, part of my brain was saying, no.
Yeah. Well, the thing that you're getting is instantaneous work, right? Where if I do work for G.I. Joe, or if I work on Hasbro or Skybound, you won't see any of my work because now it will be within the corporate system of, it's got to wait for 3 months before it comes out, you know? And I can't talk about the thing that I'm working on, where this is just like, blah, here you go. this is all my love in your face.
Okay. Since people watching this, listen to this, may go to a comic book store and you have a graphic novel published mm-hmm. through Image, which yep. every comic book store can get.
Yep.
I know you are not the world's most developed capitalist.
Yeah.
Can you, like, what's the one sentence or one paragraph pitch? Like, sell our audience on Purdy. How can you get people into their store to buy or special order Purdy?
So Purdy, there's two volumes. There's one and two, and it's like act one of the story. It's about a woman that just gets out of prison, out of Yuma prison in Yuma, Arizona. It would be Yuma territory during that time. It was the prison that they would send the worst people to. And it's the only one that housed women as well. And when I developed this story, you know, I had my ideas of who the character was, but when I went to go to Yuma, because I've learned from like what I've been saying with Monet and everything, I'd like to go to the location to see what it looks like, what it smells like, what the atmosphere is like, all that, do some studies. And then they have this fragment of the prison still remaining. The movie 310 to Yuma, that's what it's referring to, is this train that's coming at 310 is going to Yuma prison. But in the movie, it never got there. I don't think any movie has ever featured this prison before. Or a story. I'm sure there's like books and stories on it. So I went to this prison and what's remaining, and it's kind of like this little museum. And they had all these women, and you start reading like all these biographies of these women, and it's like, oh, this is horrible. The person that I made was fictitious, but I was just wanting to do at the time, I think this was 2015. 2015, 2016 that I developed the story. I wanted to, you know, do a Western, but, you know, I was like, well, no one's ever, you know, used women a certain way. there's been women in Westerns and stuff, but for the most part, they're kind of like babes and, you know, but I, you know, having been injured and not up to full speed, I was kind of thinking like, wonder what it would be like for somebody to have been in prison then come out and be the same way. Like she was a crook and a robber and a thief, not a good person. And she was very, you know, it's Purdy. Purdy is Western talk for pretty, right? And she spent the majority of her years in prison where she lost her beauty, the one thing that would help her be bad. And so I was like, well, I could kind of identify to the character of like, well, I'm kind of coming out and I'm not fully as quick as I used to be and stuff. So I kind of started playing around with this woman character. And so it's a story about this woman who gets out of prison. Sorry, it's you're saying, oh, I gotta make a quick pitch. And I start making this long pitch. But here's the quick pitch. It's about a woman.
This elevator, this elevator speech is a tall building. tall building.
Yeah, exactly. But she gets out of prison and she's trying to get back into form of what's making her bad. But part of me too is like trying to think like, I don't know, do I spoil it, you know, because it's kind of like it's a slow burn kind of comic. And
no,
the big hook is like is the big hook.
Don't spoil it.
Yeah. So I don't know. And spending a lot of time in France, you know, I was around, you know, women who, you know, because again, it's different there than it is here in the United States, and like how sexuality, you know, like what's being portrayed of like within like going out to like a mall or, you know, whatever. It's just, it's different here in America, how it's advertised of things, and being around the culture there in Paris is just like, okay. So it made me start thinking, and I was reading like this documentary too on Payne, the painter, Edgar Payne, I think his name is. He's a landscape artist. I think it was him. I don't remember now. Sorry, worst pitch ever. But I was reading this one painter, and his dad was a bad gambler, and they had to get up in the middle of the night. He remembered a few times of just like leaving everything behind. Like they had to go because the people that he owed money to were going to find him and kill him. So they had to up and leave. So this was his childhood. He remembered like leaving this. And so this was in the back of my head. And I went to this publisher and they're like, hey, we want you to do like an American comic for us. Like, you know, they don't have Americans over there making comics, or they didn't when I was there. So they were like, it would be very interesting to have an American make an American comic for the French market. And I said, well, and my brain started reeling, and I was like, started coming up with this idea of Purdy on the fly. And I said, well, it doesn't get any more American than a Western. And they were like, yeah, what else you got? And I'm like, well. And then I remembered reading about this artist's father who was a bad gambler. And I said, well, there's this woman. And then I started piecing all this stuff together. And they were like, oh, that's great. This sounds great. And I was like, okay. And it was like Musnay, where I said, like, they were like, do you have any drawings or anything? I'm like, yeah, I can get them to you tomorrow, you know. And then I went back and I just started drawing all this stuff. And I presented it to him. And so, yeah. And then, you know, all the stuff like going to Yuma and whatever is more the stuff that kind of comes right before making the actual book. The coolest thing about Yuma, Arizona, the museum or the jail that I went to, is they had this big diorama of the way it used to look. So I was able to take like photos of what this place looked like and just, you know, use it as reference. So that was pretty cool. And I was gonna have like for the book launch, because Image Comics was the publisher for that. But I was going to have like a book launch at this place, and it kind of fizzled out at the end because, again, I always does this, but somebody, one of the board members or someone was like, wait a minute, we could make money off of this. And I'm like, I'm out. I'm like, I wanted to bring people to this place and have it be this cool party, like to launch this book thing and have people come and see Yuma and see this prison and experience it. Because I went there, I was doing like a photo shoot there. I had a friend come and photo shoot me, and I wanted me to be inside the prison because they still have like all these old prison stuff, you know, like cells and stuff. And I said, do you guys have like an old prison uniform? And they're like, I think we do. And so they brought one out, and it's like a potato sack, you know, like a burlap. And I'm like, this is what they wore? And they're like, yeah. And I put it on, and it, you know, it's itchy and it's heavy and it's like woven and it's just like prickling into you and stuff. And then it's so hot there. My friend who was taking photos, he goes, oh, it was so hot. But he goes, every single time I thought it was hot, I looked at you and I was like, no, I'm okay. Because I was in the sun and I was in the prison cell and I was just dripping. I was, you know, I was reading Purdy, you know, in a sense with the photo. It was me in the prison suit. I thought those things turned out, it looked pretty fun. But
will there, is there talk with Image to release these two books as soft covers?
Yeah, you know, the problem is it didn't sell, you know?
Ah, right. So the answer is no.
Yeah. You know, the hard part with working with publishers is, you know, it's like I only have so much time and energy to promote this stuff, you know? And, you know, it's there, but at a certain point after the initial launch, it's like, you know, if they're not talking about it, nobody knows it exists. So with me, it's like, you know, it's like I did my part, if it doesn't sell, then, you know, how do I make more people buy it? I don't know. That's kind of why I went back to self-publishing, because it's just like, if I have to do all that, I'd rather just sell. And I know exactly who's buying the books. You know, I know who, you know, I'm shipping it to them. If stores buy it, like Tiempos Finales right now, I'm just kind of doing it as I'm working on it. And if you want to buy a single issue, it's expensive, right, for a comic, but it's not going to be for sale as soon as it comes to the collection. So if you want to buy like these little vignettes of what the story is as I'm working on it, then you can buy it. But it's like I'm working on it right now. And it takes a lot of time and effort to do everything, lettering, writing, coloring, the printing, the shipping, everything. So it's
almost like you're saying that someone should be compensated for their labors.
No, I'm not saying you know, again, it's like I'm talking like, as you know, as I'm talking, I'm, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, how to say this. It's not for sale. It's not saying like Image didn't do their job, but it's a company, right? It's the French company, same thing. It's like they put out a product, the next week they have new product, you know, they have to, and they can't sit there and talk about one thing over the other because they're only going to sell a certain amount. And it's hard because it's like, I, you know, not working with publishers before and then working with publishers, it's the same thing of like, I don't know how this works. I'm going to kind of sit back and see what happens and then make my decision of how I want to go about doing this, you know? And I think what I found is I was right. Me laying in bed for 4 months, 3 months, thinking about was I right or not of going with publishers, I came to the conclusion, no, I was right. I want to do this by myself. I like having this connection with the people. I like having the connection because, again, it takes forever to do this stuff. And then you put it out and I don't know who bought Purdy. I don't know who bought Musnay for the most part. There's some people, right? When you go to a convention and they come up and they say hi to you or whatever. But I know the people that are buying Tiempos Finales or any independent stuff that I'm doing. It's like, it's the same people. They're all supporting me because they like my work. So, and like I said before, it's like, I'm not trying to make record sales of stuff. I just need to make enough sales to be able to keep doing what I'm doing. And if I can do that, then that's what I'll do, because I can do whatever I want and how I want to do it. Because it's hard work, but if it's fun, it makes it a lot better.
And speaking of people being able to buy your stuff, send you money, you did have your 2024 prints for the G.I. Joes. I think that is now
I make a very small, because again, when I did that Hector Greedo After Greedo project, everybody was asking me, oh, I want to buy that original artwork. And then I said, well, this is a painting and this is how much it is. And they're like, oh, I can't buy that. So then I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I'm like, well, I could make like a little short print run of this stuff. I'm not going to keep it in print. It's just going to be this little special little thing, and it'll come and go. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. So that's kind of how I've done all this. It's just like, you know, I'm studying this stuff. I'm paying for all this paint and paper and whatnot, and the time that it takes me to do it. So it's just, I don't know. It's fun to be able to. And then for the most part, how I'm selling them is, I don't word it like this. I probably should, but it's like, if you buy a sketch, you get the print pack, you know, you get the prints for free. You know, it's like, I'm not necessarily selling like prints of this stuff. It's like, it's just, you got to buy the original sketch or something, and then you'll get the prints, or else you can just look at it online, you know, or if you're a real big fan of mine, you can print it out and hang it all over your wall, you know? So, but you have to be a real big fan of mine if you're going to print it out and make a t-shirt, you know?
I'm a particular kind of fan. I'm gonna save all these JPEGs and just crop them down to your hand holding the brush.
No, exactly. That's what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting, and I know now I'm gonna get people being funny, like sending me paintings or t-shirts of my hand holding the brush. So,
will you be at any conventions in 2024?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to go to the Joe. There's a Joe show in Texas,
the DFW, Dallas Fort Worth.
Yeah,
which is in June.
Yeah, but I don't know if I can. I want to do that. If I'm gonna do a Joe show, that would be the show. And I know, like, that's like, I think it's at the same time as Joe Fest.
It is.
Which is kind of hard to do, because it's like, man, I want to do that show too, but. A good friend of mine, he's been telling me, because he lives in Shreveport, Louisiana, and so that's pretty close, a couple hour drive from Dallas. And he was like, no, you got to come to this Dallas show. It's really, it's growing, and I think it like, Ron is going to be there, Larry's going to be there, Kirk is going to be there. I think almost like a lot of Joe people are going to be there. So it should be a big uptick this year.
If you go, you'll miss us.
Oh no, you're going to Joe Fest.
We're going to be at the other show, and
yeah.
And
why did they do that?
We recognize that the scheduling is a real a tough one for lots of people who would love to do both shows. Yeah. Mark, I am out of questions.
Wow.
Yeah. Thinking of the listeners, they're going to be thinking about, they might be discovering your work for the first time, or just being pumped up by seeing some of that gorgeous art and thinking about buying something. So I guess for that audience, you know, they can see it online on your various social medias. They can throw some money your way, or for an expensive commission to do something that is just for them, or expensive but good value, let's say.
Expensive, but it can get
it's all relative
depending on how big things get, but
if you want 6x4
6x8 is pretty good, you know. And again, it's like some of those ones that you sent, the 6x4 that's going to be expensive
if you have Facebook money.
Yeah, exactly.
Commission kick lead for a
come
door
right my way.
a door-sized oil
double
painting.
Door.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I guess it's the that we're going to cross our fingers and hope that inspiration and the urge to draw G.I. Joe kicks in before too very long, and you start thinking about the next set, and I guess moving on probably to the next year wave of characters to explore.
Yeah, 1987 is a good year. You know, I was kind of dipping into it with this last series, right? I was showing some of the movie stuff, and because it was too hard to be like, 1987 is really a good year, and it has the Defiant, you know.
My closing idea, I'm gonna try and combine two of your worlds. Go to some G.I. Joe conventions, mm-hmm. and paint the crowds and the dealers there.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Like it's a sporting event. It's like,
yeah,
here's a Hasbro designer with there's Sergeant Slaughter with a big autograph line and some long boxes of comics for the person behind him.
Yeah, I thought about it because, again, it's like, well, you see the toys and it's like, oh, that's a cool toy. I wouldn't normally buy that, but I'd like to paint it. But then I'd be sitting in front of somebody's booth doing a painting and everyone would stop and it'd be a big, huge, like, log jam in the aisle, and the people, the booth that's getting painted would love it, but the other booths that are being clogged up would hate me. So I don't know if I'd be willing to do it, but I've thought about it. You know, I've not been offered that yet. I don't, you know, again, I've gone to a few shows like Pheasants Forever. They had me at a show and I was doing that there because they had like taxidermied birds and animals and stuff, and I was like, oh, I want to paint that. I'd set up and I'd start painting it, and that's what would happen, is everything would get log jammed. So yeah, my website is the easiest way if you want to buy the current book, Tiempos Finales, that I'm working on. And at some point, like, I'll probably recollect Musne into a hard or like a soft cover collection, so it's not four books, and I'll probably also collect Purdy in the books. I just got somebody who emailed me yesterday. It was out of the blue, and she was like, hey, are you going to do more Purdy? I just read volume 1 and 2. And she goes, I want to know what happens. I'm like, I want to know what happens too. Like, I designed that as like a six, I think it's going to be, it'll be six books. So there's four more books to tell the complete story. And it's like, yeah, I just set the first two books are kind of the setup of the story. So it's kind of, I really want to get to my point, you know?
I'm going to vote for you to reprint Purdy 1 and 2, because while you were talking, after I had you pitch your own book and I told people that they could go to the comic book store and get it because it's published by Image, I checked Diamond. I checked Diamond and it's out of stock. I don't know if that means Diamond moved all of its copies to Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, it's out of print, I believe. Yeah.
So everyone, just go to Kickley's website and throw some money at Kickley and send a message saying you're interested in one of these past books coming back into print. Mark, what, you ordered the pack of prints and an original painting?
Yeah, you should have it. I shipped it to your store. So. These are like stuff I work. This is like 600 some page books. Like, I fill them up with, during the pandemic, while I was sitting, I had to go downstairs and watch my kids to make sure they were doing the homework from school, you know, because they were on the computers and my kids were lying to us saying, oh no, we did everything. And then 2 weeks would go by and the teachers were like, they're not sending in any of their homework. And we're like, what? They're saying they're doing it. So I had to be down there watching them. So I got some of these books that I'd bring to Paris and fill up. I went downstairs and I just started drawing. I'm like, I'm just going to fill these things up and learn. Like, I finished my Jedi training in the sense of what I started in Paris, but then I kind of stopped because I was doing comics. And I'm like, no, I'm going to finish my studying here. And my kids were watching me do this because normally they would run upstairs and go, oh, what'd you work on today? And I'd show them and they're like, wow, that's really cool. And it's finished stuff, right? So I was working down there and they're like, this is how you do this? like, this is how you go about drawing. You know, they would see like all the preparation stuff that I'd do, you know, not just the finished piece. They would see me working on it. And so my daughter started drawing like this too in her sketchbooks, and my son as well. And I think it's like, I really clicked in my head of like, oh no, they're seeing the magic show, right? They're seeing, oh, dad did this today. Dad did this, dad did this. But they didn't see like what I actually, how I got there, the stages of that. But it's like, I've got books full of ideas, you know? I've got any kind of genre that I want to do. It's just, it's now at the certain point of like, I want to get one going, self-published, and that's why I chose Tiempo Sonales. And once I get that going, then I'll come and start doing the other things. So it becomes easier. You know, I don't want to launch with 5 books and then never finish any of them. So that was kind of the frustrating part with doing, you know, at least with Musne. Musne was like a 4 issue thing. And it was like, okay, it's done. I want to continue it, but this is at least kind of, you get a story arc. And Purdy, you get a story arc, but it's ended at a point where it's like, okay, I like this, but not, I want more of this, you know? So it's not to say Purdy 2, by the time you get done reading, it's like, what's going to go on next? You just want to know more of it. My wife told me, she goes, I just watch Purdy doing anything, you know? She's like, I don't care. She's like, it's just fun watching this character go. And yeah, because it's kind of a humor. Like the thing is I did a Western, but it's funny, you know? Sorry, should the interview be over?
Well, Mark,
and then,
Mark's,
you know, when I was 12.
It's like 2 a.m. where Mark is.
No,
so.
I know, I'm sorry, Mark. See, the lights went out. Mark's the light's been out for a while. And Mark's out.
It's like, yeah. Oh, the sun's going. No. Yeah. That was great, Kickley. It was great hanging out, getting the, not just to talk about G.I. Joe, but to understand, you know, where it's all come from. So thank you so much for taking the time and being so generous with your time and talking to us. And I'm sure people will be very interested to hear your story and you know, how you've got to where you've...
Hopefully there'll be other announcements regarding G.I. Joe, if your wishes come true, you know.
Yeah.
If you want me to work on other stuff, hopefully.
My tempered wishes.
Yeah. More Joe, but keep enjoying it.
Yeah. Right kind of magical Joe. All right, so we have told people about your website, and people can find you on Instagram. And Mark, shall we wrap up?
Yeah. Where can people find you, Tim, when you're not talking to me and special guests?
Video essays on TV and film at my YouTube page, at Atomic Abe, my brick and mortar comic book shop in Somerville, Massachusetts, is Hub Comics. And we just announced 3 events for April. And I write about G.I. Joe at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Very good. And if you are new to Talking Joe, you can find us at talkingjoe.co.uk. That has links to all of the places that we can be found. And with all of that said and done, we'll wrap up by reminding people, Tim, that...
Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Here it is.
Meow. Laters.
Yeah, he wants dinner. Yeah.